Hi, I'm Tracy.
I'm April.
And this is Killer Spirits.
Hello.
Buenos dias.
How are you today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Much better after this drink.
Oh my gosh, the drink today.
Y'all.
It'll get you.
It'll knock your socks off.
It's really good. I mean, if you're hanging out in a tiki bar and you want to have a little strong drink, this is your drink. It's very delicious.
Order a mate.
Yeah. So make sure you go check out the picture on our Instagram because it's actually quite beautiful as well.
I agree.
So how did you make it today?
So a little backstory on the Mai Tai. It was invented in 1944 at Trader Vic's in Oakland, California.
Very close to where our story takes place.
This is just obviously the legend. I mean, who really knows?
Oh, it gets better as it does. Drink it too. It's so good.
It like sweetens up a little bit, I think. So Trader Vic's was, I don't know if it still exists or not.
They have alcohol. I saw it in BevMo.
They do have like branded stuff. It was like a Polynesian themed tiki bar. Mm-hmm. So he was the creator of a lot of tiki drinks that are popular now. The Mai Tai was very popular in the mid 40s, which is the time period we're talking about in 1945.
Correct.
And this was like the shit. Like if you went to the bar in California, you were like ordering a Mai Tai in the late 40s.
Nice.
So this drink, of course, we always measure for two. So for two drinks, I did 3 ounces of an aged rum. I did a Barbados rum, but it really doesn't matter. As long as it's slightly brown and not spiced rum. No Captain Morgan, no Sailor Jerry.
Spice rum would really kick your ass.
It would be just wrong. Good.
It wouldn't taste right.
You could also use white rum instead of an aged rum if you'd prefer that, but this is the original recipe.
Okay.
I also used 1 ounce of Grand Marnier, which is orange liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
Yummy. The expensive shit.
Yeah, we didn't bootleg it this time, guys.
The bootleg one is fine if that's what you have to do, but the Grand Marnier is so much better.
I think the taste is just, if you're going to have a drink with it, just get the good stuff.
Just get the good stuff. And I mean, it's $20 the small bottle, 350 milliliters.
But you don't use that much.
You don't use that much.
An ounce for two drinks.
Right, exactly.
So it's worth fine. It.
Then I did 1.5 ounces of key lime juice. I think that you could go a little bit shy on that.
I agree.
Maybe with regular lime, 1.5 ounces is fine, but with the key lime juice, it was tart.
A little bit too tart. Yeah.
So do that to your liking. And then 2 ounces of orgeat syrup, which is made with, it's a French syrup that's made with almonds, which is also California. The nut of California, I don't know.
It is.
And it's made with apricot pits. So you can buy Orgo, like, they have small batch, Orgeat.
Oh, my God. I'm like, what is it called, girl?
Orgeat. You could buy it, like, small batch, fancy kind, but you can also just buy, like, the Tirani's almond syrup.
It's made with what pits?
It's made with apricot pits.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
The apricot pit has an almond scent and flavor.
Oh.
Almost more so than an almond. Like, it's like that fake almond flavor. Yeah,
I know what you're talking about.
That is apricot pit.
Okay.
And then you shake all that with ice in a shaker, pour it over fresh ice into a glass, and then float 1 ounce of dark rum over the top.
Mm.
So good.
It is really good.
And then I garnished with a couple pineapple wedgies, a cherry, some mint, and a lime wedge.
Yes.
But you can be as creative with that as you want to be. And a straw.
Looks great. And a straw. I love it. It's really good. And the layering effect is very pretty as well.
Very pretty. Yeah, check out our Instagram at Killer Spirits Pod.
Killer Spirits Pod. As you may have guessed by listening to a few episodes of the Killer Spirits podcast, we look up some pretty questionable information online. Without context, some of our interests could appear pretty suspicious. That's why we use Surfshark, the VPN service we trust.
With Surfshark, you can protect your online identity and keep you and your family's online activity private at all times. Surfshark can offer the assurance you need that you are browsing privately with encryption so no one can track or steal your data, including hackers, companies, or bots. Their strict no-logs policy ensures that even Surfshark can't track you. They don't keep any record of your online activity. You can change your IP address to hide your location to avoid tracking.
With the S-Alert feature, Surfshark gives real-time alerts when your emails and passwords are at risk of being hacked. And with their clean web feature, you can surf the web with no annoying ads, trackers, malware, or phishing attempts.
One of the most unique things about Surfshark is that you can protect your family on an unlimited amount of devices for a super low price, and they have 24/7 customer support. Follow the link in the description to support the show and sign up for Surfshark today at prices starting as low as $2.49 a month.
That is a seriously incredible deal for a little extra safety and security for you and your family.
Agreed. Go check them out in the link in the description.
Okay, so today I'm going to jump right in because this is kind of an involved story. And we are going to talk about California, 1945. And we're going to talk about Thora Chamberlain. So in 1945, Thora Afton Chamberlain was 14 years old. She lived in Campbell, California, and attended Campbell Union High School. And if you aren't familiar with where Campbell, California is, it's a neighborhood within San Jose. It's about 40 miles from San Francisco, so kind of all in that area over there. She was born on November 22nd, 1930, and she was one of three girls. And she was a very happy, popular teenager. She loved to attend church on Sundays. She played bass viola in her Sunday school orchestra.
Viola?
I know. They had a Sunday school orchestra, which I think is really cool.
That's cute.
And she was learning to play the piano, so she was very smart. She'd actually spent three summers cutting apricots and picking prunes in Victory Garden. So she just really liked to keep busy, and she was just an all-around really good kid.
She sounds wholesome.
Yes. She loved her church. She loved her parents. A lot of articles describe her as a Bobby Soxer, and I know people have heard that term before, but yeah, that was a term derived from the ankle socks that were popular for girls at that time in the 40s, mid-40s. And the term Bobby Soxer referred to teenage girls who were wildly enthusiastic about Frank Sinatra and Benny Goodman. Like these singers, they just, you know, went gaga over and you see them like crying in the crowds and stuff. So
like literally having a complete meltdown.
Right. Like boy crazy, you know. And Thora was described as quiet and trustworthy and not necessarily boy crazy at all. She was... Also, she also had brown hair, blue eyes, and she was about 5'2". So she's just a little thing.
She was very beautiful. I looked up her photo.
She's freaking adorable. Yeah. I will definitely post a photo of her. She looks 14 and does look wholesome AF.
Yeah, she looks like the perfect 14-year-old girl.
She's so sweet. So on November 2nd, 1945, at about 3 p.m., Thora left her high school with a group of her friends. I think there was probably about six of them. She was wearing a gabardine coat. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. It's basically, you can look it up. It's a kind of coat that has a very, it almost looks like corduroy.
Like gabardine?
Gabardine. What did I say? Gabardine?
Gabardine?
It's gabardine. Sorry. Oh, okay. It's a gabardine coat. Yeah. So it kind of looks like a really small corduroy kind of situation. And so she was wearing that, a blue sweater, a white blouse, a red shirt, two pairs of overlapping Bobby socks. One was red and the other was blue, one on each foot, and tan loafers. She was also carrying textbooks, a zippered binder, and a cowbell, which she was going to use to ring during the football game. So they were on their way to the high school football game. It was kind of like in between these two different high schools. And they were excited. It was Friday. Also, a side note, World War II had just ended like a few months before. So there was definitely an air of like happiness and joyfulness in the community. They were walking along Winchester Boulevard
And at that time in 1945, the high school was about 2 miles down the road from the Winchester Mystery House.
Oh, okay.
So I know you and I have not been there. That's another episode. I mean, I've been there, but you haven't been there. So this, if you know that area, you can kind of envision where they were walking. They were walking down that road. It's a very long road. The high school where she was in 1945 actually closed in 1980, and there is a new location now. So a blue Plymouth sedan pulls up beside them on the street and calls to the girls, the man inside. He's about 30 years old. He's got thick, wavy black hair. He's got a nice smile. He's wearing a Garrison hat with a water-repellent cover and a U.S. Navy-style white T-shirt with a purple heart and a blue insignia bearing the words Londonderry, Ireland. Pinned on the shirt are several other service medals.
So, on a T-shirt?
Yes. And, well, he had, like, a jacket, too.
Oh.
So, I mean, he had, like, he looked like he was dressed like a military, like a Navy man.
Right.
And it was actually very common to see ex-soldiers, airmen, Marines around the city, because around this time, there was over 800,000 Californians who were returning home from the war. It was a lot. So this is just a normal, like, if you're hanging around San Diego, you're going to see a lot of servicemen, because that's also a normal situation.
And once they come back from the war, it's not like they go right back to the base or work right away.
No.
They usually give them time off.
Also, the unemployment rate was super high.
Yeah. They have nothing to do.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the girls approach the car, and he tells them he's in a pickle. He needs some help. Okay. Just don't FYI, adults never ask basically children for help ever.
Nope.
So he said he needs someone to watch his sister's baby for just like 30 minutes while he and his sister run errands. And Thora says, you know, we're sorry, but we're on our way to a football game. And he's like, oh, I know, but I'm desperate and I am willing to pay you $5. He pulls out $5. Now, $5 in 1945 is a lot of money, especially when you're 14.
Especially after the war just ended.
Especially after the war just ended. And Thora says to her friends, okay, I'm going to do it. So just save me a seat at the football game. And she gets in his car. And probably the fact that he's wearing a service uniform made him seem much more trustworthy, unfortunately. Yeah. So at 3:30 p.m., a woman by the name of Ella Boudot, who was in Saratoga, which is a town less than 6 miles southwest of Campbell, she was walking to her mailbox when a blue sedan sped by, coming down the freeway from Los Gatos, like nearly hitting her. So like she had to jump out of the way. Mm. She fell onto her mailbox. As the car sped by, she's able to see into the window and she sees a teenage girl with curls, brown hair, wearing a red skirt and a blue sweater. The girl's face is pressed against the car's window as she claws furiously at the glass, trying to get out, looking terrified. So beyond the girl, she also sees the man who's hatless with bushy hair driving with both hands on the steering wheel. So at 5 p.m., it's halftime at the football game. She's not there.
Right.
Thora's friends realize, you know, she hasn't made it yet. So they're like, la, 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 because, you know, they're freaking teenagers. So they're like, oh, I guess she didn't come back, blah, you know. At 7:30 p.m., her parents, Frank and Lola Chamberlain, are starting to get worried. Because they knew she was going to this football game, but she should have been home by then. They were thinking around 7. So they start calling her friends. One of her friends tells them, I'm sorry, but she actually never made it to the game. And then she tells them about this man in the blue sedan that came up to them when they were walking. So, of course, after hearing this, her mom freaks the fuck out, as any mom would, and they call the police. 6 days go by. Nothing. No leads, nothing. So the FBI is actually brought in, and they start working the case. And the man in charge is Earl E.J. Connolly, and he's actually a very interesting man. He was born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, and he joined the U.S. Army as a private in 1917. And then 2 years later, he was promoted to the rank of first lieutenant. So once he was out of the Army, E.J. completed his law and accounting studies in New York and joined the FBI as a special agent in 1920. By 1927, he was appointed as inspector and rose to the rank of assistant director in charge of major investigations in the field. So he worked the top cases.
Yeah.
Okay, very high-profile cases. He was part of the nation's most notorious, deadly, and violent gangster investigations also. So okay. He actually helped bring down John Dillinger and the mom and son team of Ma and Fred Barker.
Hey, the Barkers.
Hey.
Okay, so he's
a smart dude.
He's got it going on.
He's got it going on, yeah. And also, in response to the abduction of Charles Lindbergh's baby, which had happened multiple years before, people are always talking about Lindbergh's baby. I know I talked about it in another one. I want to say it was 1921 or something like that. Please, nobody quote me on that
date.
Was
Lindbergh like a famous person?
Yes, he was the pilot. Yeah, it's fine.
So stupid.
Yes, no, he was wealthy and he was a pilot. And his baby, I think he was 18 months old, was kidnapped.
Oh, shit.
And then they found the baby's body later. So in response to this, there were some changes that happened lawfully.
Okay.
Yeah. Congress passed the Federal Kidnapping Act in 1932, and the new law granted authority to the FBI, then known as the Bureau of Investigations, to work kidnapping cases that cross state lines. So that's why now we have this whole situation.
Yeah.
So EJ worked closely with Robert Emmett O'Brien, who became the city's second police chief nearly 2 years before that, in 1944. So Campbell, FBI working together, which was a good thing. It seemed like they worked well together, too. So the FBI was also working on another missing child case. This is just an aside. I thought this was kind of interesting. There was a 3-year-old boy named Dickie Tum Sudan who disappeared the day before Thora disappeared. From his parents' cabin in Goodyear's Bar, which is about 3.5 hours from Campbell. Okay. No connection at all. Mm-hmm. But the FBI was busy on both of these cases, kind of around the same area.
Gotcha.
So some believe that he had been dragged away by a mountain lion, while others thought that he was murdered or kidnapped by someone in order to receive a ransom. Because I feel like kidnappings for ransom were kind of like a thing around this time.
Did anybody ever ask for a ransom?
No, that's the thing. So nobody ever asked for ransom, and no clues were ever found, except they did find a child's glove in the woods nearby.
Well, that could be anything.
It could be anything. But interestingly,
that's the only thing they had.
That's all they had ever, which is so sad. So this child was never found. No evidence was ever found.
That's crazy.
It is. But interestingly, to this day, many people have claimed to hear the screams of a young child in the woods around this area. It's called Goodyear Bar, but it used to be known as Slaughter's Bar.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but he, of course, was never found. So that was kind of a sad thing that was happening at the same time that Thora was missing.
It's so wild how the kid is there 1 minute and then just disappears literally forever.
Yeah, that's why people thought that possibly he was taken away by a wild animal.
Yeah.
So as far as Thora is concerned, there are witness sightings claiming to have seen her alive in different places. Mm. So the San Jose Evening News received a telegram that says, quote, Thora Chamberlain, daughter of a San Jose contractor, was seen in Long Beach about 10 a.m. And the telegram assigned a friend, Campbell High School class of 1944. Okay.
Okay.
A call to the Chamberlain family, her parents, was placed from Long Beach Tuesday night. And, you know, Long Beach is southern California. So multiple hours away.
Yeah, it's not close.
It's like 8 hours away from where they are. So somebody placed a call to them around 10 p.m. And then the next morning they got another call from Long Beach around 9. But nobody says anything.
So something is up with Long Beach.
Yes. And police also discovered that a man who gave the name George O'Neill phoned the telegram that was received to Western Union Tuesday, claiming Thora was in Long Beach, and he gave his address as the local YMCA. But when police went to investigate, they didn't find anybody by that name that stayed there.
I mean, of course not.
No.
Yeah.
Her parents also sent a statement to the newspaper appealing to the public to help locate their daughter. So around November 13th, the FBI and so many days have gone by here with nothing.
Right.
So around November 13th, the FBI and the local police start looking hard at this man named Thomas Henry McGonigal. Now, McGonigal was an ex-convict who was suspected of stealing a footlocker from a Navy man. And inside that footlocker were clothes that matched the description of the clothing worn by the man in the blue sedan. So that's kind of how they connected these two things.
Gotcha.
Thomas Henry McGonigal was 31 years old. He was born on May 28th, 1914 in Covell, McLean County, Illinois. He was 6 feet, 3 inches tall, weighed about 183 pounds with blue eyes, a ruddy complexion, and a scar on the right side of his forehead above the eye. He was one of 8 children, and most of his family still lived in Illinois. And he worked as a bus driver, a truck driver, a guard. He was currently working in a construction yard. So he was basically like a jack of all trades. Mm-hmm. But he was also a boxer in his youth, so he's very scrappy. And he had no military background. None. He had been in jail for vagrancy and assault, and he did 8 1/3 years for attempted rape. And then back in May, he was booked into the San Mateo County Jail for an alleged assault on a 14-year-old girl in San Bruno. But the family did not prosecute because they didn't want their daughter to have to go and testify. And they were also concerned about the publicity. And so when they did a little bit later, they're going to do a little bit more investigation on that. And she definitely was 100% raped. And I think that's why.
What a shame.
Yeah, they didn't want to do that. And she was very traumatized. So McGonigal is married to a woman named Ina. And they had a baby literally a few days before Thora disappeared. She was born on October 30th, 1945. And Thora disappeared on November 2nd. Mm-hmm. So he is working in a construction yard, but he is like the shittiest employee ever. Like, he's the worst. Like, he basically just doesn't show up for days at a time. And then he just randomly shows up whenever he wants.
Does he have drug problems?
It doesn't sound like he has drug problems. He's just a shitty employee.
Oh, he just sucks.
He just really sucks. Yeah. So he'll just like not show up for days. He comes, clocks out. Like, he's like, he doesn't really pull his weight when he's there either. And the FBI has, at this point, less than circumstantial evidence. And they basically have a hunch. Like, okay, right. We have a hunch like this guy is something. But it's the only lead that they have after all of these days. So E.J. Connolly assigns a few men to find and follow McGonigal and not let him out of their sight. So the other agents start interviewing anyone and everyone affiliated with this guy. Mm. They take photos to Thora's friends. They do a whole lineup. I think like 5 of the photos were cops. 1 was McGonigal.
Okay.
All 6 of the girls pick McGonigal out separately.
Of course, yeah.
They said he's the guy in the blue sedan.
I was going to say, I mean, you have, what, 5 witnesses?
Exactly. So when the FBI interviews the men that McGonigal works with at this construction yard in Burlingame, they learn that the day after Thor disappeared, he actually showed up to work. He'd been gone for multiple days. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, he did just have a baby. So you might think, okay, maybe that's why. But mm-hmm. showed up to work and was like, oh, hey, I'm back. And the boss is like, are you fucking kidding me? Okay, fine, go to work. He told his coworkers he'd been gone because he was with a 15-year-old girl and what a great time he had. I think his words were she was a sweet little cookie.
Disgusting.
Disgusting. So they also find it interesting, the cops, that on November 6th, lazy-ass McGonigal is suddenly a model employee at the construction yard and is practically begging to be the one to put in extra time to dig some holes.
Oh.
And build a ramp.
Huh.
Interesting.
You would.
His boss also tells the FBI that he hasn't been to work since the day he built that ramp. So November 6th. He hasn't seen him since. And this is like the 13th. Then they talk to McGonigal's wife, who says, well, I don't know. He just left. And they're like, what do you mean he left? She's like, he just left me the keys to the car, said he was going to LA by bus. Well, why? She doesn't know. Okay, you just have a baby like a couple weeks ago and you're just.
She's like, bye.
Going on a bus to LA for no apparent reason and leaving your wife? That's just so weird. Not suspicious at all. So the FBI impound the car. They head out towards LA to track him down.
So he even has a blue sedan.
Yes. Okay. They're like, oh, look at this fucking car. It's literally the car. Yeah. They take it into custody. So once the FBI gets to the bus station in LA, you know, they're looking around. And they just notice this group of teenage girls. And they're like, let's go talk to them. Because this guy's a total perv. And
yeah, have you been approached by anybody?
Well, yes, they had. So they go up and show all these girls McGonigal's photo. And of course they saw him. And of course he had asked one of them to go with him to babysit his sister's kid
for him. Luckily, they all declined, so he went about his way.
The story is the same.
Exactly.
I mean, he's caught.
He's totally caught. So they were unable to track him in L.A., so they headed back to Campbell because they're like, fuck. So at this point, they think that possibly he has Thora with him, though, because they don't know what's happened to her at this point.
That's true.
She could be stashed somewhere. She could be with him. Like, we need to find him. Anywhere. Yeah. So time is of the essence at this point. So E.J. Connolly reached out to the FBI offices in the West and Midwest to get more manpower. They had a sneaking suspicion that he might go to Illinois, I think, but they didn't have any evidence that he'd gone there because he has family there. So they did end up getting a tip that McGonagall was seen in Cottage Hills, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so agents wanted to locate and follow him, but they weren't ready to approach him in case he did have Thora somewhere. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to mess that up. So he was there visiting his sister's family for Thanksgiving. Isn't that sweet?
Gross.
Yeah.
Hopefully his last Thanksgiving.
And why are you not with your wife and child? Who knows?
Who knows?
So the orders, of course, were to locate and follow, not apprehend. November 23rd and 24th, agents follow McGonagall from bar to bar. He just basically is bar hopping all over the place to keep track of him. And I kind of think his sister doesn't want him in the house is kind of what I get from this situation.
Yeah, it sounds like he's probably an asshole.
Yeah. He does stay the night at her house, I think one or two nights. So they are watchful of that. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't stay there very long. Word is spreading, though, that he's wanted. And I think he's getting skittish because they're asking around. Mm-hmm. So he knows something's up.
Yeah.
So he tried to make his way to Quincy, Illinois, but he basically has zero money because he hasn't been to his job.
And he's been just spending it at the bar.
Exactly. So when a car pulls over and offers him a ride, he takes it. And this is going to happen multiple times, and usually behind the wheel are undercover cops.
Okay.
Yes. Perfect. It's very interesting. They're
like, so what are you up to?
Hey, buddy, you want to ride? And he's like, sure. Can you drop me off at this bar? And they're like, yeah, no problem. They take him to the bar, drop him off, immediately call some more undercovers who basically go into the bar, and they're sitting at the bar with him.
Right.
This continues for days and days.
That's actually very smart.
It is very smart. It is. I feel like it would make, like, a really good movie.
Well, and also, like, they're not dealing with a very sophisticated criminal. He's kind of dumb, obviously. Yes. So he probably doesn't catch on.
He doesn't.
And if he did, it would be too late by the time he did catch on.
At one point, he does catch on. But at this point, he hasn't caught on yet. So he gets the ride. He goes to the bar. He has zero money. I don't know why he's asking to go to a bar. That's very odd to me. What are you going to pay? How are you going to pay for this? He doesn't care. He goes to the bar.
Maybe he doesn't pay.
Well, in this case, he doesn't. He just walks out. But then the cops who are there, they tell the bartender, okay, fine, just bill us, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're the FBI.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's fine.
We're footing the bill for
this guy. But also, that was the other thing. So they're sitting at the bar, and he's basically, like, complaining to them, like, I have no job, I have no money. And they're like, oh, you know what? You should just go to the YMCA. I'm sure you'll get, like, a bed and some food there. Mm-hmm. And you should go try getting a job at this factory place. So they call the FBI calls YMCA and it's basically like, give him what he wants. We got the bill. So they can keep track of him. He's there.
Right.
He gets the bed for the night. Didn't pay a penny.
Also hilarious that he does not even know this is like, why are people being friendly to me?
Why am I paying nothing?
Yeah. Why are these guys just being so nice all day?
Right. And then, of course, the next day he leaves to go find a job and they basically tear that room apart.
Oh, yeah.
Because they want to see if there's any evidence. So they go in, they tear the, and they do, under the mattress, they find a .32 caliber Colt revolver.
Yikes.
And so
he left it at the YMCA?
Left it and never came back for it.
Oh, because he was trying to ditch it, probably.
Yep. Yeah. So after this, he went to, like, the factory district. Maybe he didn't find a job there. I have no idea. But he lights out of there, and I think he's starting to understand, like, something's going on. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, they're on a multiple city trail after him.
Yeah.
So first, he hops a ride, because this is a lot of hitchhiking happening. He hops a ride to Taylor, Missouri. He makes stops in Hannibal, Shelbina, Macon, Bevian, Brookfield, Chillicothe. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. And finally, St. Joseph, Missouri. So he's like all over Missouri.
Wow.
And every time, you know, then they have to get, like, a new squad of FBI agents taking over the trail.
Oh, my gosh.
There's just so many. They begin working in teams following him. So from St. Joseph, he hitches rides and finally reaches Lexington, Nebraska. Then agents from Nebraska begin following him, and they continue doing that until he hitches a ride to Denver.
And then the Nebraska FBI team radios their colleagues in Denver, and then the agents in that city have to take over the case. So on December 6th, so this is all these days, he's just like bing bong. I mean, it's not even that many days. He went a lot of places.
December 6th, you said?
December 6th.
So he was in Illinois for Thanksgiving.
Which was like the 24th and the 25th.
Right.
And now this is December 6th. Oh, they've been following him around.
He's been all over the place.
He's been all over. So on December 6th, undercover agents pick him up hitchhiking again. And he asked to be dropped off at the bus station. And I know there was, at one point, he was like in a quote-unquote cab and probably realized that the person driving was a cop or an FBI agent, because when they stopped, he just like jumped out and like ran off.
Or maybe he just didn't have money to pay.
Well, that was another ride. He didn't have the money and he told the guy, and then the guy was going to beat him up, and the guy was an actual cabbie. Oh. He was a mess. He was all over the place.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So he gets taken to the bus station, and he's going back to L.A. So you got agents on the bus, and then you got agents waiting for him when he gets off the bus.
Wow, the FBI really...
They did a thing.
Yeah, they really buttoned this up.
They were really... So they're like, you know what? We're taking him in custody when he comes back to L.A. Because at this point, you've torn apart his room. They didn't have a lot of evidence, but they did find the gun. And he's like, it's time. Okay.
Well, he's been named by so many people at this point.
Right. And also, he's bouncing around all over the place. And where's Thora?
Right.
We still don't know where Thora is.
Right.
So it's like, just take him in at this point. We're done with this. So... when the bus gets to the bus station, all the passengers walked off except freaking McGonagall. Okay? He had to be carried off the bus because he was unconscious. He had taken a boat ton of sleeping pills. So, of course, they had to get him in an ambulance, take him to the hospital. That was the whole thing. I know, he's so dramatic. When he regains consciousness, he's not talking. A couple days later... the FBI are like, we're doing a lineup. He's going to be in this lineup. We have him in custody now. I want all those girls in here.
Yeah.
So Thora's friends come in, immediately choose him.
Right.
He's the man in the car. So the FBI interrogates McGonagall for 3 days.
And probably all individually identify him, too.
Oh, yeah. They all individually.
Because they separate him.
They do.
So it's not like the kids can conspire.
No. They all did it.
Yeah.
So they interrogate him for 3 days. And they're still operating under the hope that Thora is alive. Somewhere. So Thomas is saying nothing. McGonagall's saying nothing. They tell him he was identified by 5 girls, that he was the man in the car that drove away with Thora. Finally, after 3 days, he tells him, okay, she's dead. That's it. Okay, she's dead. He tells him he thinks he killed her, but he's not sure. Mm-hmm. He was just driving along. He's minding his own business, you know. Took her to Santa Cruz on Highway 17, and she was scared and wasn't cooperating. So in response to that, he took the gun out of his glove compartment just to scare her, though. Just to scare her.
Oh, I'm sure it scared her.
Yeah. And they ask, what kind of gun? And he says, well, a .32 caliber. Well, that's the same gun that they found.
Like, oh, the one you room. Left at the YMCA.
Yeah. And he's like, well, if I shot her... this is the scenario that happened. Mm-hmm. Like, if. Everything's if. That's like, actually, he has no memory of it.
That's a an interrogation technique, too. It's like a hypothetical.
But this is him saying it.
I know, but, yeah.
It's stupid. Yeah.
It's like, it's not outside of you, though. Like, we know.
Right. Like, yeah. I understand, like, the FBI is being like, well, if this happened, maybe this happened. Right. Yeah. But this, like, he's saying, well, if I did it. You know, this is kind of what happened. He says he kept driving, drove north on Highway 1 to Devil's Slide, and dumped her body over the cliffs there because he thought she was dead. He thought he shot her.
He thought he shot her.
Everything's thought, think, if, blah. Okay.
If I shot her, this is where I would have dumped her body.
Yes. Hmm. So he says he did. He said he actually did. So Devil's Slide. Have you ever heard of Devil's Slide, since we do kind of live near this area? No. So Devil's Slide is a 1.3 mile trail off Highway 1 that got its name from the sheer rocky cliffs that are like super dangerous.
Hard pass. I would never go there.
Yeah. I don't even know. Like there's been.
I don't do heights.
It's prone to rock slides. That's why it's called Devil's Slide. And it's also been closed. Like if you look up Devil's Slide, it's been closed multiple times since like 1930 something. Because of these rock slides. Like, it looks terrifyingly dangerous.
So McGonagall says he found the bullet that killed her in the car. He took it out after he dumped her body and took it home and buried it in under a tree in his backyard. That's what he did with the bullet.
It went through her body and he found it in the car. Okay.
Yeah. So on December 16th, a set of FBI agents dig up his backyard and they find a 32 caliber bullet.
Wow. Okay.
Another set of agents head off to Devil's Slide to search for her body. Now, searching these cliffs is not an easy task. And no. It's also freaking 1945. So
it's not like you could take a helicopter in there.
No. I don't even know if you could even now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they didn't really have good equipment. Mm-hmm. So these agents, these two or three agents, they basically took a 60-foot length of rope around each of their waists, which was the only thing keeping them from falling more than 300 feet to their deaths in this crashing, swirling water below, and jagged rocks, too. With the other end of the ropes, they just tied it to their Ford sedan front bumper, and they were basically hanging out over this cliff trying to find her body. So they picked their way through rocks and boulders while going down the sheer slide area.
The commitment to the job.
I'm telling you. I mean, it's crazy. So after hours of searching, they find two pairs of red and blue socks found stuck in the rocks about two-thirds of the way down the cliff. Now, Thora's parents say that the socks do look exactly like the ones that she was wearing. So that's how that's as most as they could identify them. But they know they're onto something. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you going to find some Bobby socks here? So the U.S. Navy is brought in to search the water below the cliff. And that is also not an easy task because waves are crashing against the rocks and it's difficult to see anything with like the spray and the foam. Mm-hmm. And it's also dangerous as fuck. Like one of the divers was knocked out three times by the swirling water. The swells were like 20 feet.
Oh my God.
That's also commitment. Like they were there for multiple hours trying to.
I mean, there's no way she's down there though.
Well, that's kind of what they said.
I mean, there's no way she didn't get pulled out.
Yeah. They basically were like, the likelihood of a body hanging out down here is very low, and most likely the body would have been swept out to sea after it, but it probably was most likely torn apart by the rocks.
Oh, yeah, I could definitely.
Yeah, so they did try, but they didn't find anything.
Yeah.
And now the FBI is thinking, you know, remember when we spoke to McGonagall's coworkers, and they said how keen he was to build that ramp back in November? We should probably go take a look at that area. So they go dig up the area and they find a shit ton of evidence.
Oh, of course.
They find a pair of gray trousers. They find Thora's brown shoes, her school books, a zipper binder, and the cowbell that she had with her that day for the football game.
Oh.
And the footlocker. About 4 feet long, plainly marked as belonging to a U.S. military serviceman. So the one that
So they actually stole. Got everything right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they also dug up a 32 caliber gun, another one, and pieces of bloody upholstery from the car. Oh. So McGonagall tells them, because they're like, what's up with this upholstery? Like, they go back and they, you know, interview him again. And he's like, well, that came from the front passenger side of my car. I cut it out. And I buried it to hide the blood that basically came gushing out of her mouth after I shot her. And he just, like, says it, like, matter of fact, just like that. He's like, yeah, you know, I couldn't clean it. So I just cut it out. I'm like, great. Okay. So we have this evidence.
We have a confession now.
We have a confession.
We have eyewitness testimony.
Correct. But we have no body. But they do have those other things.
Right.
So on December 18th, Santa Clara County Grand Jury returned with indictments against McGonagall on relatively mild kidnapping and child stealing charges.
Okay.
So the district attorney, Leonard Avila, decides not to ask for this little Lindbergh law that I talked about, which would allow a jury to determine, assuming they were to convict, whether he should be sentenced to death or life in prison. Because he thought, okay, we'll save that nugget until her body is located. Because they were confident they were going to find the body for some reason. So they decide, again, once her body's recovered, we'll go whole hog about this. But now Thomas's story starts changing, of course. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, whoa, 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 I never confessed. That's a lie.
I was unconscious when I was taken into custody. I never said a damn thing. I don't know what you're talking about. He also wants to fire his public defender and represent himself, which is a red flag to me when it matters all the time.
You're 100% guilty if you're going to fire your lawyer exactly. and represent yourself.
He ends up not doing that, but he wanted to. So his story...
He's stupid.
So the story now is that he took Thora to Devil's Slide, but she was alive. She was alive in the car with him. He parked. He fell asleep because, you know, he's just so tired. Mm-hmm. He heard a gunshot, and when he woke up, Thora was gone. I don't know what happened to her. Poof. She out. Isn't that wild?
Yeah. What about the bullet under the tree, you ding dong?
Okay, yeah, he'll talk about that too. So he is housed in San Quentin State Prison while he awaits his trial.
Right.
Okay. Now, he could have been housed in the Santa Clara County Jail, but it's not.
You don't house people in prison when they're waiting for trial.
Exactly. But there's a reason they did this. So this is also an interesting aside. Okay. Mm. So the Santa Clara County Jail is, they learned their lesson that it's not secure enough because 12 years prior, there were two suspects in a kidnapping and a murder case. Another kidnapping of a wealthy family, kidnapped, I think the son was 21. He was an adult. Kidnapped him for ransom.
Right.
But they ended up murdering him, these two dudes.
Rude.
Very. He was a well-known businessman's son by the name of Brooke Hart. So they were waiting in Santa Clara County Jail for their trial, and the public was ballistic. They were mad. They were pissed. They basically stormed the jail, took these two suspects. So they never actually got a trial. So these were suspects because they didn't get their day in court. Okay, guys?
Right.
Did they commit the crime? Probably, but, you know. So they strung them up in the trees.
But that's not how the justice system works.
Correct. And...
They strung them up in the trees,
killing them while a radio station broadcast the entire thing live.
Oh, my God. How have I never heard about this?
Exactly.
That's
Look it up.
That's fucking insane.
It's insane. So they don't trust putting anyone in, like, high profile like this. Because it's ballistic again.
That's crazy.
When you see stories about, like, oh, my God, people beating people up and streaming it on Facebook is so crazy. Well, guess what? They used to do weird shit like this back in 1940s,
no
too.
No kidding.
It's not a new concept. Yeah, so if anyone could be mobbed and basically hung, it's probably Thomas McGonagall at this point because the public is pissed.
They're like, actually, we're going to need you behind some taller fences.
We're going to need you in a very, very secure prison. Yeah. Yes, and also his story keeps changing. So his court-appointed defense attorneys, Stanford Smith and Bert Snyder, and the district attorney who will prosecute the case, Stephen Wyckoff, all have their work cut out for them on this case. Okay, so first, McGonagall claims he didn't shoot Thora. Instead, he actually choked her to death. He says that. Then he says, "Wait, you know what? Actually, I didn't shoot her or choke her. I stabbed her." And then later he says...
What does it matter? You're still admitting to killing her.
He's just fucking with people, I think. And then later he says, oh, you know, I actually didn't toss her body off a cliff, but I buried her in a drainage ditch near the construction yard where I worked. So then, of course, they had to deal with this other interesting aside. This disgusting piece of shit is now a sex symbol. And all the women are falling all over themselves to see him in court and send him shit.
I hate people. I really hate people.
The actual.
That is like just quintessential. Fuck. Like, I just, that is one thing I will never in my life ever understand.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like other serial killers, like fucking Ted Bundy. It's like,
I hate it.
He is on trial for the rape. Well, I don't know if he was really on trial for the rape, but I mean, he probably at least tried to rape her or wanted to, and murder of a literal child. And you are...
A complete innocent.
It's mind-boggling.
And that's what you're turned on by?
Yeah.
Disgusting. Shame to you and your family.
I agree. So luckily, the judge does rule that there is enough evidence to charge him under the Federal Kidnapping Act.
Good.
Also known as Lindbergh Law. Mm-hmm. So even without Thora's body, the judge is like, yeah, we're doing this.
I mean, they would have to, because what about the kids who they never find?
Exactly.
You can't just wait for a body forever.
No, you can't. So that's good. So McGonagall's wife, Ina, is basically like, I'm sending you divorce papers.
Yeah, no kidding.
While he's in prison, which spins him out completely. Like, he is so surprised how she could do this to him.
Okay.
And then he changes his story again. He's like, oh my God. You know, he gets these, his divorce papers, and he says, he calls the warden in, and he's basically like, listen, everything else I said was a lie, but now this is the absolute truth. And this is like the confession that he had written to his wife in this letter. Mm-hmm. He says, okay, here's really what happened. I'm going to tell you, this is the actual truth. Thora jumped from the moving car, and that's how she died. I didn't actually kill her. Okay? So that's his most recent piece of shit story.
Okay.
So his trial happened in February 1946. And during the trial, he changes his story again. Now Thomas says he did murder Thora at Dunes Beach in San Mateo County. But he did not toss her body off the cliffs at Devil's Slide. Instead, he says that he wrapped her body in a blanket. He tied it up with a rope, and then he threw her into the water, which is basically held back by the Crystal Springs Dam at Dunes Beach. So this is the fifth story that he's told, which seems like there's more stories. But,
right.
The fifth story about her abduction and murder, and the eighth search that the police have made for her body in different places. So this is why I think he's enjoying sending them off on these wild goose chases.
I mean, God bless them for still doing it, but.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, they did for many years, too. So after many eyewitness accounts, it's not looking good for him, though.
No.
So this is another interesting aside. So at 2:35, the same day that Thora disappeared, two sisters, Carol Ann and Yvonne Rapp, were only 7 and 8 years old. Please just keep this in your mind, how baby tiny they were, okay? They had stayed 30 minutes after school to help their teacher clean the blackboard. Adorable. So as they're walking home, a blue sedan, 2:35, same day, just, what, 20, not even, is it maybe 20 minutes before he sees Thora? He pulls up to the curb next to them and beeps his horn, and he says, hey, can you help me? I need someone to babysit my little girl. She's about your age. You want to come play with us? So Yvonne is like, well, okay. I mean, it kind of sounds fun. Like, I want to go play with somebody. But Carol Ann, the younger of the two, badass, is like, hell no.
You tell him, Carol Ann.
Grabs her sister's hand, and she's like, we're not doing that. And they run off. Good. Okay. Then they see this car do a U-turn and head towards Campbell High, which is where he went next.
Okay.
So this fucker was basically going to kidnap and rape a 7 and 8 year old child. And then these little girls went to court and testified.
Hell yeah.
That he was the man who tried to lure them into his car at 2:35 on November 2nd, 1945. Good. I mean,
that's incredible.
They are badasses, both of them. So, of course, his attorneys work on their reasonable doubt portion of the trial. First, Stanford Smith and Bert Snyder raised the possibility that Thora's socks, discovered on the cliffs of Devil's Slide, were thrown there but she just threw them herself. Okay. After she tossed her socks, they speculated, Thora might have run away barefoot.
Okay.
We don't know. Perhaps she wanted to get away from her family as much as she wanted to get away from McGonagall. Who knows?
Maybe she threw herself over.
Right. And what about the blood on the trousers, though?
Oh, his
from
trousers.
That were found buried in Burlingame construction site.
Right.
Stanford and Bert contend that could have come from anyone.
Okay.
There's no proof. They remind jurors that the blood on the pants is Thora's blood because we don't have the technology that we have now.
What about all the other shit that was under there?
Right. Thomas's attorneys also argue his initial confession actually proves he never intended to end her life. So even if he did kill her, he should not be judged guilty of first degree premeditated because it wasn't his intent to do so.
Although he was luring kids into his car. So I don't know how much more premeditated you get.
I mean,
premeditated kidnapping.
What a tough job to have as a defense attorney. Like, you're just pulling shit out of your ass at this point. Yeah. Okay, so McGonagall takes the stand. He's a complete schmuck. But all the girls are swooning over him in the courtroom, whatever. So he was literally having the time of his life being the center of attention up there. Like, he's grinning. He's making the fucking courtroom laugh.
Which I hope threw him off his game and he said something stupid.
Well, his story now is that her death was accidental. Mm. She didn't want to go back to school. She was literally enjoying herself. He was driving too fast and he got lost. He doesn't exactly even know where this happened, but he probably knows where it happens. And all of a sudden, she's having the time of her life, but then she gets scared and she jumps out of the car. Mm-hmm. He pulls over right away. He put her back in the car. He did his darndest to get her to a hospital.
Right.
But he just wasn't fast enough. And after 5 minutes, he realized, oh, she's dead. So he gently laid her body on the side of the road. He covered her with leaves and dirt. He said a prayer for her eternal soul. And he left her there. This is where he explains the bullet hole in his car. He says it was an accidental shooting that took place several months before Thora went missing. It's nothing to do with Thora. He just accidentally, like, the gun went off in the car.
Okay.
Yeah, and he also said those socks, you know, because he's getting cross-examined. Oh, those must have been planted by the FBI. I don't know anything about nothing about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're trying to frame me. And again, he's actually entertaining the courtroom. He's making people laugh. At one point, the judge approved for the jury and freaking McGonagall to take a day field trip to go locate Thora's body on this location on the side of the road.
That doesn't exist.
Which, interestingly, is the same spot that the two prisoners that I talked about earlier were hung from the tree.
Oh, that's interesting.
Isn't that interesting? But then the next day, McGonagall comes in the courtroom and says, nah, you know what? Not doing that. He tells the judge he doesn't want to show the court where Thora's shallow grave is because he heard through the prison grapevine that an angry mob could be waiting for him there and he feared for his safety.
Oh, my God.
Oh, he's a showman for sure.
This is one of those things that you watch and you just want to choke him out yourself.
I do. I
You're like, just give him to me.
Writing this made me want to choke myself. Yeah. Like, I'm just like, this is fucking wild, okay? And it just keeps getting more wild, okay? We're not even done with wild yet.
Oh, my God.
So the jury, 5 women and 7 men, took only 37 minutes to reach a verdict. Guilty of first-degree murder.
Good.
37 minutes. So luckily they were
They're
not-
like, actually... We just followed along with all this just to see what you were going to do.
Yes. And it's interesting because They're like,
field trip? Yeah.
At one point, there was 6 women and 6 men, but one of the women juries ended up passing out during one of the testimonies, and they had to replace her with the alternate. So it was 5 women, 7 men.
Huh. Was that due to the nature of the testimony? Or
possibly.
Was it?
Oh, yeah, okay. Possibly. So now he's facing the death penalty.
Good.
And he's genuinely surprised. Like, he's like, what? You convicted me? I can't believe it. It's like, really?
Really?
So on February 26, 1946, he was sentenced to death by the gas chamber. So they had one more day of that conviction. So on April 19th, 1946, so he's languishing away at San Quentin, a junk dealer by the name of Franklin Hogmeyer was hiking around Devil's Slide. Like,
you said junk dealer?
Yeah, he's a junk dealer. So basically like
he sells antiques or something?
No. They call it junk dealer because it'd kind of be like your modern day guy out with his, like, you know, beep, 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 beep. What's that thing
like
called?
Oh, like a metal detector.
Exactly. So he just
goes and finds junk.
He just finds, or quote unquote, treasures.
Okay.
And he's selling them. That's what his wife That's wants cool. him to get a real fucking job. And he's like, what do you mean? I got a job. I'm a junk dealer, man. And he's like, you know, so that's what he does.
She's like, oh my
she's
God.
She's like, could you get a job? Like, she's a waitress. She's like, can you please, like, pay for some money? Because we're literally.
This is my dream.
We're living in a motel.
Oh my
Okay.
Gosh.
They're living in a motel.
Yeah, poor wife.
Yeah, so he's like, fuck you, man. I'm going to go get my junk. So where am I going to get my junk? On the side of this fucking cliff, apparently. That's where I'm going to go.
He went to Devil's Slide to get his junk?
He's going right. I guess people lose some good shit down there.
I mean, they're not going to retrieve it.
That's for sure. So he's looking for his treasures to sell. Mm-hmm. He finds this small gold cross necklace.
Okay.
And as he's reaching for this necklace, whoopsie, he grabs a human hand.
Okay.
Yes, so he had stumbled across a decomposed body on the cliffs. Okay.
Talk about a fucking day, you know?
We're not even half done
You're
yet.
Just strolling through life, dealing your junk. Yeah. Find a necklace you're excited about. You could probably get, you know,
look at this
25
necklace.
Bucks for it as you grab a decomposing hand.
Correct.
Ah.
So... this is the part that gets me, though. The FBI are like, what? You found a body? So their reaction apparently is to go to San Quentin, grab Thomas McGonagall from prison.
Why?
Stick him in a car and take him out there. I wish I understood this.
No, leave him there.
Does the FBI do this now? Like, you just, you're like, you found a body? Let me go get this guy to see if this is Thora, because they're just certain this is Thora.
Why
right?
would they?
I don't know. It's the weirdest thing ever. That's okay, bizarre. The 40s, man. I don't know. So anyway, they get him out. They take him over there. And he has been on death row since March 5th.
He's not going to further confess.
And also, he's changed his story 100 times.
And also, if he does further confess, he's already convicted to death.
Right, but he is working on appeals, baby. He's reading every law book he can get his hands on.
I see.
And he's actually certain he's going to win because of something called corpus delicti or delicti. I'm not sure how to say it, but it's Latin. And it means concrete evidence of a crime.
Okay.
In his case, he's certain there is no concrete evidence of a crime. So he's hung up on this corpus delicti thing, like over and over and over. That's his golden goose, I guess.
Tattooed on his chest.
Pretty much. Corpus delicti. Because he's like, well, her body's never found, blah, blah, blah. So when agents, they go get McGonagall in tow, they go make their way to Devil's Slide, where this shallow grave is. When they take a look at the body, they discover it's actually an African-American woman, probably in her 20s, not Thora.
No.
So McGonagall takes one look at this
body. But they could have checked that out before they took him down there.
Which is interesting. They fucking take him down there. They look. He's looking at her and he goes, oh, that's Dorothy. I killed her.
Huh?
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at that. I'm laughing at your face. Yes. Just super matter of fact. Oh, yeah, I killed her.
Oh, that's Dorothy.
That's Dorothy. Yeah. And so they go, they find out it is Dorothy. Her name is Dorothy Rose Jones. She was 23 years old, and she was a waitress in a restaurant near Howard Street in Campbell. He tells the FBI, look, man, it was purely self-defense, okay? We'd been drinking together, and she fucking tried to stab me, so I had to do it. It's not my fault. He's just, like, super nonchalant about it. So,
okay.
Here's another body, Devil's Slide. Apparently, he likes Devil's Slide. So, the FBI still do not have Thora's body. They were certain that it was her. So,
are they going to convict him of the other murder that he just confessed to?
Well, they end up not, because they think it's not going to matter. Right. So, they're like, okay, well, this is in our back pocket, though. So, the dude, Franklin Hogmeyer, who found the body of Dorothy, the FBI hires him, and they're like, look, you keep searching. We need Thora's body. Oh, yeah,
totally.
Keep on searching this
area. I mean, you're the guy with the skill to do it. Yeah. You obviously found a body.
I mean, you found one. You might find another, right? And Franklin is only too happy to oblige.
Oh. Okay?
So every day he makes his way to Devil's Slide. He conducts his search. On April 24th, 1946, so, I mean, how many days later is that? So this is only, like, the next week, because he found Dorothy on April 19th, yeah. Okay? So April 24th, goes down to Devil's Slide for the day with his wife, Loreen, who apparently was super excited, he said, to assist him in this search until they got there. And then she's like, I'm just going to stay in the car.
Probably because he's like, I'm actually have a purpose.
Yeah.
Someone's actually asked me to do this. And she's like, great. Maybe you can make some money off right. of it.
But she didn't want to do it. So she stayed in the car. He's like, I left her in the car. She had some fucking alcohol and some sandwiches, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
And he's like, okay, I'm just going to go down and I'll come up at lunch and, you know, whatever. See you then. So he goes down the cliff, returns a few hours later, and she's gone.
Well, that's weird. In the car or she's gone?
She's gone.
The car's still there.
The car's still there, but his wife is not there. Car is locked up. Her purse is inside.
What?
He has no idea where she could be, but you know, he's tired, he's hungry, he don't have time to go be looking for that shit. So he takes a nap, he eats some lunch, and then later he's like, oh, I guess I should tell police, I can't find my wife.
Oh, like maybe she just took a walk or something.
Without her purse?
Yeah, who knows? Weird.
It's kind of like also in the middle of nowhere. It's probably like, I don't know if it's more in the middle of nowhere in 1945, but I think it's probably still kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know? So he goes to police. And he's like, my wife is missing while I was looking for this body. So police are like, fuck, now we got another person to look for at Devil's Slide, right? I mean, did Lorraine wander off and just go to like a bar, which is what Franklin was saying she probably did, but right. she left her purse in the car. She has how's nothing she with her.
For, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, how's she going to buy anything? So did she have an accident on the cliffs?
Yeah, like maybe she fell down.
Was she kidnapped from the car? Oh my God. I mean, poor Franklin was just helping the cops search for Thora, and somehow in the interim, his own wife is now missing. Wild. Also,
unless he killed her.
Also, their neighbor, who was a friend of Lorene's, told police Franklin is a fucking liar.
Oh, cool.
And Lorene never wanted to go to the cliffs. And in fact, she hated the fact that he even accepted that situation. Like, oh. Okay, you're making some money, but I don't like that. It's dangerous. So police have an eyewitness call and tell them also that they are certain they saw Lorene eating a meal at the Dollhouse Cafe in San Carlos, which sounds really cute. I wonder if that still exists. So they're getting an eyewitness account. Okay, well, maybe she's alive. Someone told us there she's eating somewhere, you know, which is not far. San Carlos is not far from there. On May 2nd, 1946, police, who are still searching Devil Slide, they find a white sandal on the cliffs. And then they also find a gray coat. Both match the description of clothing worn by Lorene on the day of her disappearance. They keep searching further down the hill, and they find the battered, broken body of Lorene Hogmeyer tangled in a mess of brush and small trees. And, of course, at this time, it's not just the FBI hanging out there by themselves. There are hundreds of people hanging out at Devil's Slide watching this search, yeah. And, of course, watching them, you know, bring her body to the surface, up to the top. Yeah, it's terrible. There's reporters, there's photographers, it's the whole nine. Now, Lorene's body was found 300 feet from the spot where Dorothy's body was discovered by Franklin himself. Mm-hmm. So they took Franklin into custody, but he's acting as surprised as everyone else. I have no idea what happened.
Devastated.
I'm devastated. This is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. So Lorene's autopsy showed that she had several gashes on her knees that could have been consistent with a car bumper, possibly. She suffered a concussion, but there's no fracture of her skull. In addition, she has two fractured ribs and skin burns on the right side of her body.
So she was dead before she was thrown down there?
Unclear.
Okay.
So further investigation.
And or maybe hit with a car.
That's a possibility. Mm-hmm. Like, you either are going to get hit by a car or jump off and you got hit. I mean, who knows? There's so many, you know, and again, the technology is not the same. Mm-hmm. So further investigation showed that Lorene either fell or was shoved from an observation platform at the edge of the cliff. So this platform is about 50 feet south of where her body was found. Police found two sticks of chewing gum, her coin purse, $2 in change, a key to the Hogmeyer's Ford, so she had the key in her pocket, a button from her slacks, and a bandana. And it looked like she had lost it all as she was falling down the cliff. There were bloodstains about 75 feet from where her body was found, and it looked like that's where she probably broke her fall, where the blood was. But then she must have also got up and tried to walk and fell again.
Oh, God.
Down the last 75 feet.
Fuck.
And they also thought that she possibly could have been alive for an hour or more after she finally stopped falling. In horrific agony, I'm sure. Unable to get up.
So I guess that's kind of an indication that maybe your husband didn't do it if she had the car key in her pocket.
Maybe she just got out to look at the thing and he pushed her.
Oh, maybe.
Because he left her in the car, but maybe he didn't leave her. We don't know. This is a story. No. And also, this is interesting. Two state highway workers named George Pimentel and Thomas Fahey said that they had spotted Franklin's car at 8 in the morning, the day that Lorene disappeared. And they said it was empty. No one was inside. She wasn't inside. He wasn't inside. George and Thomas looked over the cliff, and they did see Franklin working in a gully about 100 feet south of that platform that Lorene fell from. But Franklin had told police he went to work at 8:30 or 9. He said he kissed Lorene goodbye and then lowered himself down to start searching for Thora's body. So a half hour, maybe to a full hour after the state highway guys say they saw his empty car, he's saying he's kissing her goodbye. So which one is it? His timing's wrong. I think it already happened at that point, maybe in my personal opinion. Wrong. Maybe.
Hmm.
That just doesn't make any sense, though. But they give him a lie detector test, and he passes with flying colors.
Okay. That doesn't really mean anything, but it's fine.
It doesn't. Her
That's all they got.
This is going to be, it's so mysterious. Her tox report came back. It showed she was under the influence of alcohol.
At 8 in the morning.
So the theory is that she may have left the car, went to the platform, and because she was at least tipsy when she fell to her death. And Franklin was just clueless as fuck.
Because it's loud, and, I mean, there's waves crashing and shit. He probably wouldn't hear anything.
So, regardless of what your thought is on that situation, he was let go. He was never tried or anything for that. So, who knows? It is kind of mysterious. Could she have done that herself? Of course. But could he also have been like, I'm tired of being married to this lady, and this is like a really good opportunity, and he took it? Maybe.
Maybe.
No one will ever know.
But when you're married, you have lots of good opportunities.
Yeah, but that was a good one.
That was a really good one, but yeah, I don't know.
I mean, shoot, maybe he would have thought she would never have been found, just like Thora.
Maybe.
You know?
Yeah, maybe he was like, actually, this is the perfect place. I didn't even think of this place.
Right. So he was a free man, but McGonagall, thankfully, was not a free man.
Good.
And he was sentenced to death by the gas chamber, and that was to happen on February 20th, 1948. But he did have a few more tricks up his sleeve because, you know, he cannot go gently into that good night. So a Dr. Robert E. Cornish was best known back in the 40s for his 1930s revivification experiments with dogs, in which he claimed to bring dogs back from clinical death.
No.
Okay. He wanted to try a similar procedure on humans.
No.
Okay. So he actually petitioned the court, the state of California, to let him play reanimator.
They actually did this a lot with, I talked about this in a different episode.
Yeah.
Actually at specifically San Quentin that they were doing experiments mm-hmm. on inmates.
Yeah.
This was not uncommon
back then. It is not uncommon. So Cornish dogs experiments are kind of upsetting to listen to. Just FYI, I'm going to tell you a little bit about it, but it's not easy. So if you want to skip
part, well, first of all, it's not working. So
no, but this is how he would do it, which is horrific. And obviously before PETA existed, he would suffocate the dogs until they were clinically dead.
Okay.
Then he would place the bodies on this teeter board, like a teeter totter, and he would rock the bodies back and forth to get the blood flowing. In 1934 and 1935, Cornish reported two successful revivifications of clinically dead dogs. And in 1935, he also announced that he wanted to try to revive a death row inmate after an execution. Like, he really wants to do, like, a human here, okay?
Sure, teeter-totter him.
Yeah, so a couple of humans have volunteered to be brought back to life. So one was a prisoner scheduled to be hanged, and the other was a man in his late 70s who figured he had a good life and he wanted to help science, okay? But Cornish considered the first patient, but rejected him because he's like, well, your trachea is going to be all smashed. I can't have someone with physical injury.
Oh,
okay. If your windpipe's going to be smashed and crushed by a hangman's noose or whatever.
We just want you to just die.
Yeah. Like I can't bring that back.
Or suffocation.
Yeah. The second guy was told thanks, but no thanks because Cornish would have to have actually like killed him first. Which would have made him like a murderer.
Yeah.
Like I can't bring you back to life because I'd actually kill you first.
Right.
So he didn't do that. But McGonagall decided.
I guess you can't really volunteer to be killed, huh?
McMonagall. What did I say? McMonagall decided this would be a really fabulous opportunity for him. And he volunteered for this.
Right.
In 1947, Cornish petitioned the California Department of Corrections to allow him to attempt to revive McMonagall. After he was That's executed hilarious.
Can you imagine,
in the
like,
gas chamber.
The executives reading that letter? Just being like, you want a what?
So that was the warden of San Quentin at the time, Clinton Duffy. He denied Cornish's request, pointing out that after an execution, it took half an hour to vent the fumes in the gas chamber. And just to be on the safe side, the body would have to remain in the chamber for at least another half hour, or an hour at least. So Cornish was undeterred, though. He's like, okay, look, I'm going to appeal to you, Duffy.
Oh, my God.
And he said at one point, he would kill a sheep in a gas chamber, replicating the conditions of the San Quentin gas chamber, and then bring it back to life as a proof of concept situation.
Right.
But Duffy was like, no.
Hey, I don't know if you heard me, but no.
And then the courts were like, no.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's also
how shit works with that kind of like government stuff.
Yeah.
They just go, fuck off.
They're like, no. But also, like, if he had been able to revive McMonagall, yeah. I don't know why I'm getting my G's and my N's all mixed up all of a sudden. What then? Like, he would have served out his sentence and he would have died. So would the state have been obligated to release him? Like, there was this weird conversation going on at this point.
Oh, and, like, he's technically sentenced to death and he did die.
Right. So now what do we do with this revived person? Can kill we keep him again? Him
in custody?
Right. Like, there's just weird. How would the law
work?
Are
you a new person now? Do you get a new social security number? Are you reborn?
Yeah, so, like, some people have argued that the reason Cornish's request was ultimately refused was because the state of California feared it would have to let McMonagall go free if he was successful.
No way.
According to a March 14th, 1947 San Mateo Times article, Cornish claimed that McMonagall wouldn't go free because he had confessed to that second murder and he would have been tried for that.
Right.
However, just a few months later, he told the Tuscaloosa News that lawyers told him if the convict were brought back to life, he would legally be free due to double jeopardy.
Oh, my God. But it's like the other thing is, it's no. Like, they're not participating in your experimental bullshit. Like, they don't care.
No, they don't.
They have their orders to do what they're going to do, and they do it. That's yeah. The law. And that's what the court tells them to do, so that's what they're going to do. Period. Right. End of story.
And by the late 1950s, Cornish had retired from medical research, thankfully.
Oh, good.
And he was marketing his own product called Dr. Cornish's Tooth Powder and Vitamin D and Fluoride.
Great.
Yeah.
So he moved on to teeth. Mm-hmm. That's funny.
Yeah. So McMonagall also tried reaching out to a teenage girl during this time who was going blind because he wanted to offer her his eyeballs. After his execution. Is this guy too much or what? She said, no thanks.
I'd rather be fucking blind.
That's what she kind of said.
I'd rather never see again in my life than get your disgusting eyeballs in my head.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court of California rejected Thomas's writ of habeas corpus petition in December. The justices also rebuked him for wasting the time of the state and federal courts. They're like, dude, you're fucking wasting our time.
Yeah, we rebuke you.
Thomas beseeched.
I'm going to start telling people that.
I rebuke you.
Yes. Not doing this.
Thomas beseeched California Supreme Court with writ petitions three times since he was convicted of murdering Thora, and each time he lost. And in fact, the last time, Superior Court Judge Samuel F. Finley was appointed as a special referee to hear his allegations and charges of judicial error. They say, like, okay, we're really going to take a look at this. Like, we're going to do the thing for you, okay, Thomas? Judge Finley ruled there's no basis for his writ petition.
No.
Yeah, so he's like, yeah, we're done.
You're not finding anything.
So on the night before his execution, he made one last-ditch effort to delay this. He provided his lawyer some information to give to police.
That he's been sitting on till this day.
Yeah. It was a hand-drawn map that he had spent multiple days drawing, telling them this is where Thora's body was, and told them you'll find the body of Miss Chamberlain buried in a rectangular area about 500 feet north of the Blair Company construction yard, about 100 feet south from a building that has since been torn down on the edge of the corporation's yard.
Great. Bye.
He swears he put her body in a wooden packing crate that he had got from his home in San Mateo.
Thanks for the map. Bye.
Yep. Because he's thinking, okay, this area has never been.
Does he think that's going to save him from execution?
I believe he did.
Or he thinks it's going to stay his execution anyway.
Yeah, because he's saying once she was placed in the crate, he buried her 3 feet below the surface. And, of course, this area had not been searched by police yet. So he's thinking, this is good. And it's also about 200, 300 feet north of where the FBI found her books and her pair of shoes.
So it'll at least maybe buy him some time to be alive.
But the police are done with this idiot. They're like, you know what? Thanks for the map, but nope. Just what you said. We're done.
Okay, bye.
There's nothing that's going to stay your execution at this point.
Good. Except a call from the governor.
Right, which didn't happen. So on February 20th, 1948, McMonagall went to the gas chamber. having lost all appeals, and no reanimation, of course, was allowed. His last meal was ham, eggs, and a glass of OJ. He was led to the chamber barefoot, wearing jeans and a white shirt. And when they strapped the stethoscope to his chest, he said, "Don't strap it too tight," and he laughed. At 10:02 a.m., the pellets fell into a well of sulfuric acid and distilled water beneath his chair, causing a cloud of fumes. And 72 people watched his execution. And interestingly, women were not allowed back then to witness any executions.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. After 4 minutes, he raised his head and coughed, started breathing normally, and then slumped forward. Shortly after 10:14 a.m., his head shook, and then 60 seconds later, the prison doctor heard a final heartbeat through the stethoscope that was strapped to his chest and declared him dead.
That seems like not that bad of a way to go if you're going to be executed.
I think it takes a while, though.
Oh, it does.
I mean, 10:14.
But do you just, like, fall asleep, though?
I don't know.
I don't know what happens. Because, you know, there's always that argument about
cruel and unusual
which ways I think to execute people.
Most people think that is.
Oh, I would think you'd just, like, pass out.
I don't know.
But I've never been gassed before, so.
I haven't either, obviously. So, to this day, Thora Chamberlain's body has not been found.
So, did they ever search that area?
Not that I know of. The map? Or if they did, they didn't, like, find anything. Because he's full of fucking shit.
That's true.
You know?
So, main theory that she swept out to sea?
That's the main theory, but she's still considered a missing person. And so if you get on, like, the Charlie Project website, she's listed there as a missing person. So who knows if any evidence will ever happen since 1945, but it's very, very, very sad.
It's very sad.
And it's a very interesting story, you know, that he is one of the first cases that was convicted to death without a body, an actual body. So they were serious.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah. So that's it.
What a fucker.
What a fucker. And that dumbass killing dogs, you're a fucker too.
Yeah, what the fuck? You just put them on, like, a teeter-totter? Which is so, like, of course, with our, you know, modern advances and our knowledge now, it seems so stupid. But back then, it was probably, like, something. Like, people were like, yeah, that could work.
I don't get it. Like, why would you do that?
I don't know.
I hate that guy.
I hate, like, both of them. All the people in the story, you're like the fucking dog guy.
I mean, I hate all of them, but it's like, wow, you know? Why? And you know, and I do wonder, like, I do wonder, like, what happened to, you know, hopefully Thomas's wife raised her daughter and was happy and they had a good life without his ass.
Yeah.
That would be my hope.
Or, I don't know, they were all trash to begin with. Who knows?
I don't know, but it's not his baby's fault.
No, it's not his baby's fault.
All right, tell them where to find us.
Oh, my gosh, you guys. Well, if you want to email us, you can email us at KillerSpiritsPod. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/KillerSpirits. We released our most recent recipe book on there. So if you are a Patreon member, go check that out. And we have the recipe book there for you.
That's it.
Instagram at KillerSpiritsPod.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, we love you guys.
We love you guys. Thanks for listening. Bye. Bye.